Just move a little bit forward if you don't mind. The youth who are hiding behind the corner there with their phones in their hands, if you guys can come forward as well, please, as well. That'd be good. One point I wanted to make before we begin to our parents, and alhamdulillah, I see that happening here. It's good to see. I don't see it happening in most centers across North America. I don't know about all of you growing up, but when I was growing up in Toronto, one thing that we learned from this Farish-e Azab of Azadari is adab and respect on how to sit in a mahfil, in a gathering where the Ahlul Bayt are mentioned. These are not ordinary gatherings. This is not an ordinary farsh you're sitting on. It might look like a carpet or a sheet, but the reality is, we have a hadith to support the fact that whenever and wherever there is a gathering where the Ahlul Bayt are mentioned and their affairs are taught, the angels descend from heaven and they gather in these types of gatherings. They actually lay their wings down for us to sit on. And when the last person leaves this building every single night and closes up and locks up, the angel gathers its wings and goes back up towards heaven. And as it passes by other angels, it gives off a very beautiful scent. And the angels ask him, what is that scent that you give off? And they say it's the fada'il of the Ahlul Bayt. These are not ordinary gatherings. They're not ordinary buildings. For the 3 hours that we are here as special guests of Abu Abdullah. How you sit, what you wear, what you have in your hands, how you spend that time is totally up to you. If you knew the amount of restrictions that I had when I was growing up going to a majlis, my father marhum would not let me wear jeans, t-shirts, gum or candy in my mouth was absolutely a no-no. A hat, forget about it. He would not let me move from his side. If I told him I have to go to the bathroom, he'd say, you can go to the bathroom right there, it doesn't matter. You're not moving from where you are. I find that art to be lost nowadays. I find the fact that our parents have given up on their kids because the kids don't listen to what they say. And fine, it may be a language barrier, it may be several things, but when you have someone like me who comes, and I know I have a Canadian accent, but I still have the same language as all of you do, I don't find the excuses to be there anymore. So to my parents, I humbly request you, don't give up this fight to teach your children how to sit in these types of gatherings. I've been to centers where there are the elders in the front of the member and the kids are in the back wall with their feet out, as if they are sitting in some pub or some area or some basement of their friends. Or I've been in areas where, of course, the elders who are twice my age, who don't even have English as their first language, will sit there and attempt to understand what I'm saying, and the youth who actually have that language in their back pocket have no interest whatsoever in what is being said on the member. To my youth, again, give these types of gatherings the due importance that it is due. The dhikr of Ali Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam is not a blessing for everybody. We have individuals who don't have these gatherings. And we're blessed to have these gatherings. Usually, Al-Walaya invites good speakers. Now, this time around, they messed up. That's okay, though. But usually, they invite good speakers. When they can't find anyone, then they give me a call, say, look, would you mind coming down and filling the spots in? But these are gatherings that require your respect and your attention. I am as addicted to my phone as all of you are. I live and breathe by my phone, no doubt. But my phone is secondary, Aba Abdullah is first. What you wear is secondary, Aba Abdullah is first. So please, if we have khas libas for ibadat, and we do, we should have khas libas for the ruh ibadat, which is Aba Abdullah al-Husayn. Inshallah. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله الذي لا يبلغ مدحته القائلون ولا يحصي نعماءه العادون ولا يؤدي حقه المجتحدون الذي لا يدركه بعد الحمم ولا يناله غوص الفطن ثم الصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين حبيب قلوبنا وطبيب نفوسنا والشفيع ذنوبنا سيدنا ومولانا أبي القاسم محمد وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين صاحب العصر والزمان خليفة الرحمن إمام الإنس والجان ولعن الله وعداهم أجمعين إلى يوم الدين أما بعد فقد قال الله وقوله الحق بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم والذين جاهدوا فينا لنهدينهم سبلنا إن الله لمع المحسنين صدق الله العلي العظيم صلوا على محمد وآل محمد Developing Islamic courage has been our topic. Tonight is lecture number 2. Last night we broke the topic a little bit, talking about the concept of shuja'at in Islam. How to be a person who's courageous. Today, in this day and age of fitna and fasad, of corruption and of injustice and of tyranny, we require ourselves to be courageous individuals, to fight the fight, to not bow down to tyranny, to ensure that we are able to look the Yazid in the eye and show him that I am the Hussein of today. And in doing so, we require a lot of courage. We talked about last night that courage is not the amount of blood that one can shed, nor is courage the amount of bodies that you can kill. Courage is not beheading innocent individuals. Courage is not demolishing countries and invading homes. Courage is the idea of doing what the deen is asking you to do at that time. That's the essence of courage. Now sometimes what the deen is asking us to do goes against our own desires, and sometimes, alhamdulillah, the deen is asking us to do something that we ourselves want to do, and that's fantastic. But in reality, this day and age right now, what the deen is asking for us to do is to place our own desires secondary and the deen's progress to be number one. Is it difficult? It's very difficult, especially in this land. It's very hard to do that. It's very easy to go along with the norms of society, even if that requires us to break a few of our spiritual principles. But the reality is that that's not what we need today. And part of the development of courage, I talked about this yesterday for those of you who are new, and mashallah there are a couple of new faces here today, is the fact that we'll look at this topic in its full capacity across at least 4 nights. We'll look at development of courage, we'll look at what stops us from being courageous, and then of course the idea of why it's important in this day and age to be courageous. One factor that builds Islamic courage is trust in the Ahlul Bayt. We believe in them, we love them, we cry for them, we celebrate their birth, we gather in their names. We put everything aside for them. They are our identity, they are our name, everything about them. But how much do we trust the Ahlul Bayts and trust the faith of the Ahlul Bayts? We've had individuals who were beside the Ahlul Bayts. When it came time for them to trust them, they weren't able to do so. We talked about the Ashab last night. We talked about the fact that there were the companions on Shab-e Ashur that were worthy of respect. We recited in Ziyarat al-Ashur that nobody had the Ashab. Ziyarat al-Warsa, nobody had the Ashab that Imam Hussein had. And we always say, Ya laytani kuntu ma'akum fa'afuza ma'akum. If I was there, Abu Abdullah, I would also gain success with you. Who says the day of Ashura was a single day? It's not. It's a movement, it's a philosophy. Once Yazid has entered the arena, know that that land now has become Karbala. And those days now are the day of Ashura. Now we can be like the Kufans who are writing and begging and pleading with the Imam to come and help me. And they're ready to support the Imam before and after the actual events. But during Karbala, they're nowhere to be found. Because we had companions like Dahak ibn Abdullah al-Mashriqi, a story that I've told here before, I believe, maybe somewhere else. Who was Dahak? Dahak was one of those individuals who actually was in Karbala and left before the day of Ashura. There were some of those like that as well. We revere and respect those companions that were there on the night of Ashura. When Imam Hussein is listing the individuals who will be shaheed the next day, those individuals who stuck around after that list was read are worthy of our respect. There are those who came to Karbala, who actually sat there from 2nd of Muharram all the way till the 8th of Muharram, some say. And when they realized that 30,000 people on one side, 100 max on the other, they would ask for their release. Dahak was a man in Medina, where Imam Hussein, when there was news that he's going towards Kufa, people in the streets of Medina would avoid Abu Abdullah. Some say they would cross the street when he was coming towards them. Some say they would avoid eye contact. Just because if he ever asked me for help, how would I answer him? Dahak was a man that Abu Abdullah approached. He says, Dahak, you know what's happening. They want my head. The people of Kufa are asking for me to come. I've sent Muslim. He's replied back saying, yes, Mullah, they've given me bay'at. I'm going now. Jitamuna linusrati, are you going to come for my help? Are you coming for my help? He says, I'll come, Mullah, I'll come. But there's conditions. I'll come with you to Karbala. I'll come with you towards Kufa. If I find that it is a lose-lose situation, then I want my release. Abu Abdullah says, no problem, I'm not going to force anybody. Who was Dahak? Dahak was a man who fought in Siffin with Muawiyah against Amir al-Mu'mineen. And Imam Hussein is saying, Dahak, listen, your track record with Allah is not that great, brother. You fought against my father. I'm giving you an opportunity to right your wrong, to fix your book. You place conditions on me, that's fine. It's up to you, no problem. Dahak was there, 2nd of Muharram, they arrived in Karbala. 3rd Muharram, he was there. 4th Muharram, he was there. All the way, they say, up until the 8th of Muharram. He's seeing thousands and thousands load in from Kufa, and maybe one or two coming towards Imam Hussein's tent. The 8th of Muharram, he approaches Imam Hussein, he says, Mullah, we had a deal. He says, yes, we had a deal. He goes, you know, it doesn't look good for you. Thousands on this side, you're barely cracking 100 on this side. If it's all right with you, I'm gonna cash in on my condition and ask for my release. Imam Hussein says, sure, we had a deal, no problem, you can go, sure. But I don't have a horse for you, I have no way for you to get back to Medina. He goes, don't worry, I've already made arrangements. I have a horse down the road that's waiting for me under a tent. I'll hop on the horse and I'll go. He left. 2 days away from being part of the day of Ashura. 2 days away. Belief in Imam Hussein? Absolutely. Wilayat? Absolutely. A Shia? Absolutely. Trust? I don't know. Tough to say. Because the day of Ashura is not an ordinary day. It's usually a story meant for Masaib, and I don't mean to take that ruch towards Masaib, but let me just share with you this one riwayat we have from Ibrahim ibn Malik Ashtar, the son of Malik Ashtar. When he and Mukhtar were talking, when Mukhtar was sitting there on the banks of Furat, it's a very mashur riwayat. Those who have seen Mukhtar Nama, you know they actually have a scene in Mukhtar Nama on this beautiful scene. He's sitting there. Ibrahim and Amir al-Mu'min and Abu Fazl Abbas were close in age. And Abu Fazl Abbas was 15 years old, some say, in the war of Siffin, where Malik Ashtar was the general commander of Mawla Ali's army. And he would challenge Malik Ashtar, let me go fight, let me go fight, let me go fight. And Malik would kind of, you know, say, it's okay, it's okay, it's okay. And he would complain to his son, Ibrahim, that your father's not letting me go fight. He says to Mukhtar that, Mukhtar, one night we were sleeping in the same tent together, Abu al-Fazl woke up in a panic. I asked him, Abbas, did you see a dream, something, everything okay? He's like, Ibrahim, I saw the most strangest dream that has shook me. He said, I'm in some desert land, and there in front of me on the ground are my two arms. And there are birds that are eating at my arms. And I'm asking the birds, I'm begging the birds, don't eat my arms. Those are my arms. I need them. Why are you eating my arms? And after I was begging and pleading them, one bird looks at me and says, what do you need arms for when you have these wings now that you can fly towards heaven? And then he says, when I heard about the shahadat of Abu al-Fazl Ibrahim is saying, I realized the dream that he had in Siffin. The day of Ashura was a day where it was a mi'raj towards Jannah. 2 days away, the haq was. But he had no trust in his belief in the Ahlul Bayt. A lot of us love the Ahlul Bayt, no doubts. The amount that we do in these months of Muharram and Safar is incredible. The amount of money we spend that we don't have sometimes is incredible. Amount of time that we have is incredible. We take our kids, we take them home at 12 o'clock at night, they're half awake, the next morning they're in school. But all of that for who? For Aba Abdullah. It's immense love, incredible love. Is that all there is to it? The reality is, the huquq of the Ahlul Bayt, the rights the Ahlul Bayt have on us, is a very important discussion. Our Holy Prophet Muhammad Mustafa sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam is the only prophet that actually asks for a reward for his prophethood. Every other prophet says, our ajr is with Allah, our ajr is with Allah, our ajr is with Allah. The Prophet of Allah actually asked that if you want to give me an ajr and a reward, he asked for what? He asked for what? You tell me. Mawaddatun fil qurba, ahsant. If you want to thank me for anything, the fact that I have now given you a path of salvation, the fact that I pulled you out of jahiliyyah, the fact that I pulled you out of dhulimat towards nur, the fact that I have saved your akhirat, the fact that now I have cleansed your soul, I've taught you things you didn't know about, I elevated you towards Allah, if you want to thank me for that, I don't want anything. What I do want you to do is have mawaddat for my family. That's all I ask for. He's the only prophet that actually asked for a reward for what he did. Not for his own sake. Not even for the sake of his family. This mawaddat is for our benefits. So one haq that we have, which is Quranic, is the mawaddat we have towards the family. Now, before we get to mawaddat, let's examine at least five different rights. One is ilm. One is ma'arifat, one is mawaddat, one is ata'at, one is i'timad. Five huquq the Ahlul Bayt have on us as their Shias. I've mentioned this before here, I'll say it again. I was here in Sha'ban, the discussion on Mahdawiyyat, if all you remember. In that I mentioned that while the world is waiting for some savior to come, and every single form and school of thought of belief, be it Islamic or non-Islamic, even be it idol worshipping, everyone's waiting for someone to come and rescue them. We believe in a savior that not only is born, but is amongst us as well. We don't believe that he still has to be born and still go through adolescence, be a teenager, be a man, and then he'll come and save us. No. We believe him to be alive in this world, amongst us. The riwayat that are often used to compare us with the Imam is Nabi Yusuf to his brothers. They would go to Egypt, sit in front of Nabi Yusuf, and not realize that that was Nabi Yusuf, their brother. They couldn't recognize him. It's your brother. He knew who they were. They had no idea who he was. The same idea. Many of us have seen the Imam, don't recognize him. We have a right to say when he comes, inshallah, some of us will actually say, I've seen this man before. Didn't recognize it was the Imam. We know more about the Imam than anybody else does. We know 11 of his grandfathers. Everything about them. Their names, their kids, how they operate, how they learn, their sayings, everything about him. The amount that we know about the Imam that's coming, no one else does. And while that's a source of pride for us, it's also a source of responsibility for us as well. Right? The example I'll give you is that if somebody outside the parking lot is waiting for someone to come pick them up, and you ask this brother that, you know, are you waiting for somebody? So yeah, I'm waiting for person B's parents to come. Let's say Ali's parents to come pick me up. But I have no idea what they look like. I have no idea who they are. They'll come, they'll honk, I'll get in the car and they'll drop me home. You know what Ali's parents look like. So you'll sit there and you'll wait with him. You're also waiting, he's also waiting. He has no idea who he's waiting for. You know exactly who you're waiting for. If a car pulls up, he'll look to you and say, are those Ali's parents? You'll say, no, that's not Ali's parents. If a person comes up to them and talks to them, he'll ask you, is this Ali's father? You'll say, no, he's not Ali's father. You're able to distinguish and determine and tell him that the person you're waiting for is not here yet. Even if somebody, God forbid, comes and attempts to be Ali's parents, you say, look, this can't be Ali's parents. Ali's parents are like this. So you'll save him from getting into the wrong car or the wrong path. Why? Because you know Ali's parents very well. We have in our hadith, there are many false Mahdis that will come if they haven't come already. And if you don't have the proper ma'rifat and the proper i'timad of the Ahlul Bayt, and I'll explain these terms one by one, don't worry, then at that moment we'll be very easily fooled. Right now, today, there's a group that believes that the Imam is here. There are false of the Mahdi's website as well out there who claim to be the Imam, and he's here. He's announced himself to be here. And there's following. There's people in Toronto I know who follow this event, this man. It's there. So we have a responsibility in this day and age to understand that who we're waiting for, we know better than anybody else does. So when it comes to the huquq of the Ahlul Bayt, number one is ilm. How much do we know about the Ahlul Bayt? I call it the passport information of the Ahlul Bayt. Their birth date, their death date, where they're born, where they're buried. Basic information. You'll tell me 15th Shaban, you'll tell me 10th of Muharram, you'll tell me 13th of Rajab, that's fine. If I ask you a couple of tough ones, like the 9th of Imam or the 10th Imam, if I ask you a tough one like the 7th Imam, you'll say, oh, there's ikhtilaf when they're born and when they die. There's a 3 or 4 different dates, one of them is accurate. We've placed levels with the Imams, the more famous ones and the less famous ones. The basic information of your leaders is you should know. After ilm, and the ilm itself is a whole different discussion. Let me very briefly talk about that. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. The worst translation I've seen for ilm is knowledge. Ilm is not knowledge. Ilm has no definition. Ilm is a journey. It's not knowledge. Knowledge is in the brain. Ilm exists in your amal. Meaning what? Meaning that if you read a book, if you listen to a speech, if you are on, let's say, Shia TV or other sources online and you watch these videos online, everything that you are digesting resides up here in your brain. The next journey that information has up there, it goes from your head to your heart. That journey is a long journey. Why? Because we are ghafil human beings. We forget. We'll sit in a majlis like this one, for example, or other ones that are better than this one, and we will sit there and tell ourselves that from today, I'm going to change myself. You're taking notes, and oh my God, from tomorrow, that's it, I'm done with my life. Boom, boom, boom. We start salats, we start du'as, we start this, we start that. I want to get more involved, more politically active, out there, this and that, etc., etc. Beautiful. We get to the car, everything's forgotten. We're ghafil human beings. Ghaflat is a very dangerous task. That's why one of the most beautiful acts of worship that we have in our books that's recommended is something called Salatul Ghufayla. I know some of you, mashallah, actually recite. Look at the beauty of this salat. It's not my topic, but just very briefly. The ulama have identified that ghaflat, heedlessness it's called, occurs mostly at night. When we enter the night, when the sun sets, that's usually when our shaitan or our satanic powers are at the highest. A young guy at 19, 21 years old is different at 12 noon and different at 12 midnight. Our conversations at 12 noon are different. Our conversations at 12 midnight are different. Where we go at noon is different. Where we go at midnight are different. The fun that we have at 12 noon on a random Sunday is different from the fun we have on a Friday night at midnight. We tend to forget Allah at nights, and we tend to remember Shaitan at nights. That's how it is. So the ulama say what? That between Maghrib and Isha, there is a salat called Ghufayla. Ghufayla has the same root word as ghaflat. To fight this idea of ghaflat, this salat is there. Look for it online, Google it. For those of you who are stuck on your worship, a lot of my youth say, I don't know what to do next. If, mashallah, you are somebody who has your wajibat down packed, and you pray salat pretty regularly, now slowly but surely start to increase and include your mustahabat, those things that are recommended, including your nawafil prayers, including your salat al-shab, inshallah, including these namaz ghufaylas, for example. Ghufayla is a very powerful salat. I cannot stress it enough. If you Google ghufayla, you'll find how it's read. It will take you 5 minutes to recite in between Maghrib and Isha. And in there you are asked to remember the story of Nabi Yunus, the very first rak'at after Alhamd. There's a passage from the Quran that is to be recited. That passage is the story of Nabi Yunus, who, as you know, he was that Nabi Yunus that spent time in the belly of the mammal, or the whale, some say. 40 nights, 40 years, doesn't matter. And in that belly of the whale, he spent time in there in the darkest portion of the mammal, of the whale. You know that whales do not swim at the surface level of the water. They swim at the deepest portion of the ocean. So now metaphorically, I've said this before here as well, very quickly. Metaphorically now what you have a man who's in the deepest part of the mammal. The mammal now is in the deepest part of the ocean. Darkness upon darkness upon darkness. A lot of us, a lot of my youth right now, you guys are in a lot of darkness right now. Our parents don't understand their pain. They don't tell you. What they're going through sometimes is hellacious. It's very difficult. They have addiction problems. They have problems in school. They have self-image problems. Depression, anxiety, suicidal thoughts. They come in, they go straight to the room, they close the door, and you think, oh, they're on the computer doing something. No, they're on the computer because they don't choose to be with anybody else. They live in their dark world, and that world gets darker and darker every single day. And when you try to approach them, they'll shut you off. And you get frustrated, in the process you frustrate them as well. What does Nabi Yunus do? فَنَادَى فِي ظُلِمَاتِ, the Quran says. In that darkness, he calls out to Allah. لا إله إلا أنت سبحانك إني كنت من الظالمين. If anyone has made this state for anybody, I have done dhulm against myself. And then the beauty of this ayat is what? The Quran says that we heard the dua of Nabi Yunus, we freed him. وَكَذَلِكَ نُنْجِ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ أَحْسَنْتَ. We will do the exact same thing for the believers. The most beautiful solution for ghaflat is to call Allah, guys. When you are in the darkest portion of your life, scratching rock bottom, many of us run from Allah. Allah's like, run to me in that time. We have traditions that say sometimes when we ask Allah for something, Allah tells the angels, don't answer his dua just yet. I haven't heard him call my name in a very long time. He calls me only when there's a problem. And I know that the moment that this problem is solved, he'll forget about me once again. And the love that Allah has for us is not compared to any other creation, not even to our mothers. You know, sometimes when I was in Qom, I would go, let's say, a week or 2 weeks or weeks without calling my mom. And when I would call her after weeks, we talk about nothing. The weather, what she cooked that day, just nothing. But she didn't want me to get off the phone. She just wanted to hear my voice. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala loves us 70 times more than our mother, riwayah tell us. And sometimes he misses the sound of our voice. Sometimes all he wants to do is hear you. If that means you're complaining to him, then so be it. Yelling at him, so be it. If that means that, look, you'll say, look, God, I know I haven't really been around, but look, I'm kind of stuck in a bind here. Would you mind helping me out here? And he knows that, you know what, if I fix this guy's problems, he's gone again. I won't see him again. So please, just delay this dua for a second. Not in a cruel way, where he's playing with your emotions, but in a way that one creator to his creation is missing him. We sometimes have this idea where the information in our head has to descend down to our hearts. From that heart has to descend into our amal. That is what ilm is. Ilm is from the brain to the heart to amal. That's the journey of ilm. It's not considered an ilm until you practice it. Because information comes in the brain, information leaves the brain. But that information that you've allowed to descend onto your heart and now convert into amal is true ilm. We love the Ahlul Bayt, we know much about them. We even have them in our hearts. Some people I've seen, they mention Imam Hussein's name and their lip starts to quiver. That's love, no doubt about it. But Imam Hussein requires a little bit more from us. I've mentioned this example before. In India, I've been told that Hindus sometimes come out in jalooses. He's out there, you're out there in a jaloos for Aba Abdullah on the day of Ashura. He's barefoot, you're barefoot. He's dressed in black, you're dressed in black. His sleeves are rolled up, your sleeves are rolled up. He has khak in his hair, you have khak in his hair, in your hair. He's beside the alam, you're beside the alam. He says, Ya Hussein, he cries, you say, Ya Hussein, you cry. He goes home to his Hindu home, you go home to your Shia home. Is there a difference? There should be. What's the difference? I don't know. Both of you have him in your hearts. The difference is that you should have him in your amal as well. It's not enough to love Imam Hussein. It has to be that you practice Imam Hussein's ideologies. Otherwise, you and the Hindu are the exact same. And that's not that's not possible. The first level of the haqq of the Ahlul Bayt is we should have their ilm about them. Once you know somebody, then you recognize them. And that's the second level, that's ma'rifat. Ma'rifat is to recognize them. It comes from arafa. Irfan, ma'aruf, all these things are the same family of words. Ma'arifat is to recognize somebody. To not just know them, but recognize their likes and dislikes. Know how they operate. After a while, you know exactly how they are. This ma'arifat is important. Those of you who have gone for ziyarat, mashallah, we heard the poem just before, beautifully written, mashallah. May Allah bless you, sister, about this golden dome that she stood in front of in Iran and Iraq. We have a riwayat that say that, yes, no doubt, the one who visits, let's say, this individual, Jannat is wajib on them. We get happy. But the condition is what? That you have to visit their shrine or their haram with ma'rifat. To know exactly who they are. The biggest injustice done against Imam Hussein on the day of Ashura is not to do with zakhmiya and arrows and spears and blood. It's the fact that they didn't have ma'rifat of Abu Abdullah on the day of Ashura. They didn't recognize Imam Hussein on the day of Ashura. Time and time again, he's screaming and yelling, "Do you not know who I am? Do you not recognize who I am?" Bibi Zainab, Atila Zainab is yelling at Umar ibn Sa'd, "What's happening to Hussein? This is Hussein. You're still letting this happen." They didn't want anyone to do what they did to Hussein without knowing what they're doing. Ma'arifat is very important. To know someone is one thing, to recognize them is another. And then comes the level of mawaddat, what the Prophet warned from us to do. You cannot love somebody without recognizing them. You can't recognize them without knowing them. Ilm, ma'rifat, mawaddat. Now, mawaddat and mahabbat, very briefly, I'm sure it's been discussed here several times. Why not muhabbatan fil qurba? Why mawaddat? Even when it comes to husband and wife, inside of the Quran, the very famous ayat that's used sometimes on wedding invitations from student room. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. When Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that marriage between a husband and wife is an ayat of mine, it's a sign of mine. وَمِنْ آيَاتِهِ أَنْ خَلَقَكُمْ مِنْ أَنفُسِكُمْ أَزْوَاجًا لِتَسْكُنُوا إِلَيْهَا وَجَعَلَ بَيْنَكُمْ مَوَدَّةً وَرَحْمَةً. From our signs that we created from you and for you, azwaj, spouses. Why? لِتَسْكُنُوا إِلَيْهَا. So you can find sukoon inside of them. And then what? We placed between you, the husband and the wife, mawaddat and rahmat. Now some Quran say love and mercy. Mawaddat is not love. Mahabbat is love. Mawaddat is one notch higher than mahabbat. Certain individuals in their kitab al-lughat, in these lexical dictionaries they have defined mawaddat to mean the pillars and structures that hold up a building, for example. This building, for example, is up right now based on three or four main strong pillars. If those pillars collapse, the building collapses. They refer to those pillars as mawaddat. But Raghibi Isfahani, which is nowadays known as one of the key individuals in defining certain Quranic terms, says mawaddat is muhabbat plus amal. For example, you come home and, you know, mashallah, you're very good at expressing your love for your wife. You know, you tell her, "Oh, you look nice today, mashallah. I love you, honey. Things are well. I'm very happy with you. Everything okay, this and that." You express your love, mashallah, a lot. It's good. The Hadith, the Prophet says that when you tell your wife that you love them, it stays in her heart. We should express our love. But after a while, if she's asking you to do certain things, and you refuse to do those certain things, and you keep telling her, "I love you, I love you, I love you," eventually she'll say, "Look, take your love and leave here, please. Your love to me is lip service. If you loved me, you would do this. If you loved me, you would do this. If you loved me, you would do this." So when you start doing this and you express your love, then that becomes true love. Right? You express to your wife that you love her, you don't help around the house. You express to your wife that you love her, you don't let her go shopping. You express to your wife that you love her, you don't let her go see her mother, for example. You express to your wife that you love her, you have all these sort of conditions on her. You express to your wife that you love her, but you are a zalim in the house, God forbid. That love means nothing after a while. That expression of love means nothing after a while. It has to be joined with amal. Mawaddat is true love, where not only is it a verbal expression, it's a display of affection as well. The Ahlul Bayt require not muhabbat from us, they require mawaddat from us. Well, yes, with our tongue we say, Ya Abba Abdullah, I love you, Labbaik, Ya Hussein, we say 1,000 times. But when Imam Hussein says, look, I need you to do this as my Shia, are we doing that or not? We have love for Ali in our heart, no doubt. But when Imam Ali is saying, look, walk my path, are we or are we not? It's easy to love perfection. It's hard to follow that path of perfection. What the Ahlul Bayt want from us is something beyond expression of love. They need somebody, us, to follow that path. So not only is it muhabbat, it's muhabbat plus amal as well. That's why it's important that not only do we cry for Abu Abdullah, we understand his mission, why he did what he did in the day of Ashura, and repeat that over and over and over again. And then attempt to tread his path. That becomes mawaddat. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. After mawaddat now comes the fourth level, which is what? Ata'at. To follow them. You can't follow them unless you love them. You can't love them unless you recognize them. You can't recognize them unless you know them. When you follow somebody, and this is the law of love. The law of love says, look, if I have claimed this person is worthy of my love, I do things to, what? Please them, and I avoid things that displease them. Sacrifice. In a marriage, that works. Between an imam and his ma'mum, it also works as well. To follow the Ahlul Bayt is to do what they want us to do and to not do what they don't want us to do. That's following them. Again, it's one step higher than mawaddat. Right? Ata'at that we have in the Quran is the idea of following their path. How difficult is it? It's very difficult. Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq, alayhi salatu wasalam. He's sitting with his companions. And there were some companions who would be obsessed with this concept of the Mahdi coming and establishing divine government on this earth. I mentioned that last night here after the majlis. There are some companions who were absolutely obsessed with that. And he would describe to them what the last era would be like before the arrival of the Imam. He took a very sharp plant in his hand. Some say it was a cactus. And he said, how many of you would be willing to squeeze this cactus in your hand right now? It's a very sharp plant, right? He says, nobody would do that. The Imam says, the deen of Islam and protecting your deen during the final days before the arrival of my son Mahdi will be more difficult than squeezing this cactus in your hand. There won't be a single square on this earth that will be a source of sukoon for a mu'min before the arrival of the Mahdi. Our iman is being tested day in and day out. Right now we believe that we are comfortable. We're comfortable here. Our test is coming. It will come. That's how Allah will differentiate between the mu'min and the one who gives lip service and the one who actually has iman, is through a test. God's system is through tests and hardships. And the Quran says, لَقَدْ خَلَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ فِي كَبَدٍ. We were the ones that created the insan in the cradle of distress. We put him there to see exactly how you react. Now some, mashallah, get up and move forward. Some curl up in a ball and say it's hopeless. My youth especially, you guys, become hopeless very fast. Ayatul Dasqib Shirazi Rahmatullah Alayhi is a man who wrote that very famous book called 50 Greatest Sins. It's a big red book that is translated into English. He says, after shirk, the second greatest sin is hopelessness. Mayusi, as you guys call it. Naumidi. In a world where that is controlled by Allah, there's no room for hopelessness. That's where we are. Our test is coming. And if we leave the path of the Ahlul Bayt, it becomes very difficult for us to maintain ourselves. That's why one dua that Allah has made wajib on us 10 times a day. One dua, 10 times a day is what? Ihdina as-siratal mustaqim. Certain duas we recite one day a week. Thursday night, dua kumail. Tuesday night, dua tawassul. Certain duas in the month of Ramadan. This dua is not once a day, it's 10 times a day. The frequency of the dua tells us about the importance of that dua. If there's anything else that's the most important factor, it's hidayat. And it works for everybody. If you don't have hidayat, Allah, please bring me on the path of hidayat. If I do have hidayat, Allah, please protect me on this path of hidayat. It's coming, guys. The big test is coming for us. If it hasn't already. And a lot of you right now, to safeguard your deen, you guys are going through a lot. And I'm with you, I'm in Toronto now. It's very difficult to give yourself time for yourself, forget anything else. The biggest complaint my youth have is I don't have any time. When you have kids, when you have a spouse, what will happen? I don't know. Right now, if there's no time, later on, you won't have time either. Now, a lot of you will sit there and tell us, look, Sayyid, with all due respect, that was Imam Hussein up here, and we're down here. Or they say, Udu Voto Mola Ali, he was up there. You're asking us to follow his path. It's not possible. The example I'll give you is very simple. Very simple example. Mundane example. I have a 1-year-old daughter at home. And when we put her in the high chair to have breakfast with us, we give her the food and she eats the food. When she's done after a while, she wants to get out of the high chair. The high chair is, let's say up to here, I'm about 6'4", so I'm a lot bigger than she is. I'm up here, height-wise, she's all the way down here. What does she do to get my attention? She kicks and she screams and she bangs and she reaches and she tries to get up to where I am. She cries and she screams and she does this too. My one does, she does a lot of this. She goes, I want to get out. She gets my attention. And she forces me to come down to her level and pick her up to my level. Sometimes we need to kick and scream for the Ahlul Bayt. Reach for the Ahlul Bayt. Bang on things for the Ahlul Bayt. Fine, he's up there, Mawla Ali. We kick and we scream and we cry long enough, he'll come down and pick us up to his level. Have we tried that? Let's try to kick and scream and bang on things and get his attention. Say, look, Mawla Ali, I want you to come down to my level and guide me at this level. I'm nothing to compare to you. I'm not worthy of anything. But I have love for you. I want to follow you. It's hard sometimes. I can't do it sometimes. This society pulls me 10 different ways. But I'm kicking, I'm banging, I'm screaming, please, please pick me up. He'll come down, he'll pick you up. Just try it. Ask him for help. Ask the Ahlul Bayt for help. This is the process of following. Once you follow them, the last stage then is what? Is trust. I'timad. It's trust. Absolute trust. When Abu Dharr is asking Salman al-Farsi, if you saw Mawla Ali drink alcohol, God forbid, what would you do? Salman is asking Abu Dharr, what would you do? He would say, Amir al-Mu'mineen, I can't believe you're drinking. What's happening? What's going on? How dare you? Do you not know Sharia? What happened? And then Abu Dharr asked Salman, what would you do? Salman says, I would start drinking as well. I'timad. Trust in the Ahlul Bayt. We need to start doing that. The biggest blessing we have inside of our hearts is that of the wilayat of the Ahlul Bayt. No doubt about it. That blessing requires trust right now. Because you don't get the ashab that the Imam had on the day of Ashura without them trusting Imam Hussein. Saying, Imam, we are drowning ourselves into you. Because we know that you are drowning yourself into Allah. We are everything for you and you are everything for Allah. That trust our Imam and our Hussein of our time needs from us. Trust it. We have to know them, recognize them, have mawaddat for them, follow them, then trust them. Five levels of huquq of the Ahlul Bayt. Which level are we at is the question. And I ask myself that question. Love is there. How much do we follow them? How much do we know about them? How much do we recognize them? Because there comes a time where when you trust the Ahlul Bayt, you're willing to give everything you have for them. Everything you have for them. Even to the point where you go against your fitrat sometimes. The ajeeb and strange musibah that we see on the day of Ashura is the fact that some things are fitri inside of us, guys. They're innate inside of us. But on the day of Ashura, that fitrat is completely gone. Allama Tabarisi, Sahib Tafsir Majmul Bayan. It's an amazing story. He says that one day I was reading about the Azamat and the greatness of the Ashab of Imam Hussein. How nobody had the companions that Abu Abdullah had. Not the Holy Prophet, not Amir al-Mu'mineen, not anybody. And for a moment I had a little bit of doubt and shock in my heart that how could it be possible that nobody had the companions that Imam Hussein had? With that doubt, I went to sleep. In my dream, I found myself on the day of Ashura in the land of Karbala, standing in front of Abu Abdullah. Imam Hussein says, Tabarisi, it's time for Salat. We are going to pray Salat right now. I want you to stand in front of my Jama'at and protect us from the arrows of the enemy. Tabarisi got happy. Abu Abdullah had a mission for me. He deemed me worthy for this mission. I stood there in front of the Jama'at. The Salat began, Allahu Akbar, and arrows came my way. And one arrow I saw come directly in front of my face, and my instinct was to duck. So I ducked. And the arrow struck Imam Hussein in the chest. I woke up in a panic, upset at myself, crying. How could it be that Imam Hussein asked me for a mission? I let him down. That same night, the second night, the same dream, the day of Ashura, land of Karbala, Tabarisi stand in front of my Jama'at. This time I told myself, I will not duck. The second arrow comes and I duck again. And the second arrow strikes Imam Hussein in the chest. The third night, Imam Hussein is standing there, the day of Ashura, two arrows in his chest, and says, Tabarisi, you have the audacity to question my ashab. Zuhair ibn Qain took 21 different arrows for me during that salat. 21 different arrows. My brothers and my sisters, when something comes flying towards you, when something is thrown at you, the instinct, the fitrah is to do what? Is to protect yourself, to duck, to somehow move out of the way. These ashab of Abu Abdullah were such, they weren't moving to avoid the arrow. They were moving to confront the arrow. The fitrah went out the door on the day of Ashura. The fitrah of the mother towards her child is what? To protect them from any harm. She will take scar after scar and take injury upon injury if it meant to protect her only child. She'll take a bullet if it meant the child is not shot. But the mothers of Karbala were different. That fitri love the mother has for a child was second nature. The first was, Ya Abu Abdullah. These were mothers who were actually grooming their children to sacrifice their life on the path of Abu Abdullah. Can you imagine? What mother does that? Which mother does that? How many mothers do you know would do that? But the thought of my child living while the children of Abu Abdullah are dying is not an option. Shabi Ashur, Imam Hussein is going from tent to tent to tent, making sure everyone is okay. In one tent, he could hear the sound of crying. He enters the tent, he sees Rabab sitting there crying on Shabi Ashur. He says, Rabab, why do you cry? She says, Mola, everybody else has children to sacrifice for your path. I don't have anybody who's at the age of sacrificing. All I have is a 6-month-old Ali Asghar and a 4-year-old Sakina. Little does Rabab know, the greatest sacrifice of any mother on the day of Ashura was Rabab's. The same Rabab that when they came back during the days of Arba'een, back to Karbala, she's sitting there at the foot of the grave of her husband Imam Hussein. Zainab says, Rabab, it's time to go back to Medina. She looks up at Zainab and says, Zainab, you want me to go back to Medina? But who am I going back to? I brought my entire house here. I left my Sakina in the Zindan of Sham. I left my Ali Askar, my Hussein, here on the plains of Karbala. The same Rabab that when this kafila now has leaving towards Karbala from the Zindan of Yazid, and Bibi Zainab says, Rabab, I don't see Rabab anywhere. The kafila is ready to go back to Karbala. Yazid has given us our freedom. Where is Rabab? I don't see Rabab. Rabab is sitting there at the grave of Sakina and saying, Sakina, you used to ask me that, Mama, these birds are flying home. When are we going to go home? Saying, Sakina, we're going home back to Medina now. Rise up from your sleep, Sakina. Come with me back to Medina. This was Rabab's sacrifice. Now that wasn't enough. The 6-month-old Ali Asghar, who was taken out there for a drop of water. When Mukhtar arrested Hurmala, and Mukhtar asked Hurmala, that Hurmala, what was your role the day of Ashura? He says, Mukhtar, I shot 7 arrows. 4 of them hit my target. 3 of them missed my target. And one by one, he announced which 4 hit the target. When it came to the 4th arrow, Mukhtar says, Hurmala, tell me about the 4th arrow. He says, Mukhtar, what do I tell you? Umar ibn Sa'd says, look, this 6-month-old child in the arms of Hussein is thirsty. Quench that boy's thirst. I picked up a 3-pronged arrow that I use for animals, and I shot at the neck of this 6-month-old, where I pinned the neck to his father's arms, and I witnessed with my own eyes that Imam Hussein Rabab, together with the Zulfiqar, dug the grave of Ali Asghar in the sands of Karbala. سَيَعْلَمُ الَّذِينَ ظَلُمُوا أَيَّ مُنْقَلِبٍ يَنْقَلِبُونَ إِنَّا لِلَّهِ وَإِنَّا إِلَيْهِ رَاجِعُونَ.